This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're going to talk about a legal argument that, so far, has failed. The client in this case is just over 50 years old. She's been in a New York institution for 45 of those 50 years. For the past 20 years, she's been physically separated from other residents in the institution, but she can communicate with them. She will likely never leave the facility, even though there is nothing wrong with her physically or cognitively. She will live out her days there, whether she wants to or not. And because of that, her attorneys claim that she is being imprisoned against her will. Since 2018, they've argued in New York courts that their client is being illegally detained and that the legal principle of habeas corpus, an assertion to protect body liberty, must be applied in this case. Well, this summer, New York State's highest court rejected that claim in a 5-2 ruling. Quote, "We reject petitioner's arguments that it is entitled to seek the remedy of habeas corpus," wrote Chief Judge Jane DiFiore. And why? Quote, "Habeas corpus is a procedural vehicle intended to secure the liberty rights of human beings who are unlawfully restrained, not non-human animals," end quote. You see, the client in this case is an elephant. Her name is Happy, and she lives at the Bronx Zoo, which is run by the Wildlife Conservation Society, part of one of the most admired global conservation groups in the world. Happy is represented by the Non-Human Rights Project. Founded in 1995, the advocacy group has been litigating cases on behalf of chimpanzees and elephants to confer some form of personhood rights on individual animals, or as they put it, quote, "to demand recognition of the legal personhood and fundamental right to bodily liberty of autonomous non-human animals living in captivity," end quote. Now, while the Non-Human Rights Project failed to argue successfully for Happy's personhood, the judges on the New York Court of Appeals engaged seriously with the questions raised by the case. How should humans treat, quote, self-determinative, autonomous animals, especially highly intelligent, highly social ones? Or, as dissenting Judge Rowan D. Wilson put it, the case compels consideration because, quote, "the rights we confer on others define who we are as a society." Well, this might seem like a completely quixotic legal pursuit to you right now, but science has a way of complicating the picture, doesn't it? And in recent years, research has revealed more about the subtle and sophisticated cognitive and emotional lives of animals. And the more we learn, the more we inch closer to the question Happy's lawyers are forcing now about how far human law should extend into the animal kingdom. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And we'll start with David Scheel. He's a behavioral ecologist who specialized in predator-prey systems and a professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University. And he joins us from Anchorage. Professor Scheel, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, I wonder if you could just broadly describe to us how much science's understanding of animal cognition or even animal emotions has changed, what, since the year 2000, in the past couple of decades?
Sure. I think in some ways the science has been building up gradually over a long period of time. And some of what's changed in the past two decades has more to do with how we evaluate that information, how we judge it. Science and philosophy and maybe even ethics have become more willing to take the evidence that's before us all the time and sort of say, all right, there's a way to look at this in which it's an interior state of the animal that we can't see or directly measure. And in that way, it might be easier to dismiss. But there's another way to look at it in which the interior states give rise to a number of measurable things. And as our ability to see into other habitats, as our interest in animal behavior and animal physiology grow, as we begin to look into those other ways of regarding the question, the ways in which interstates become outwardly observable or influence outwardly observable things, then we become more willing to say, oh, yeah, of course, that's a valid way of approaching the question.
Okay, so interstates becoming outwardly observable things. So how would you describe, is there a commonality in what those interstates are between Homo sapien and other animals then?
Probably. There's a Australian researcher, Derek Denton, who's a physiologist, and spent his career studying thirst, the mechanism of being thirsty and what it does to the body and the mind, and then how it gets resolved so that you're not thirsty anymore by drinking. And he recognized that the sensation of thirst is an interior sensation that compels us to a specific kind of action. And in that way, it's very much like an emotion. The notion of an emotion being an inner state that we can't directly assess, but it compels certain, it's a motivator. It makes you want to do certain kinds of things. And thirst is one of those, and there's a number of other ones, like hunger and the urge to urinate. And so all of these together, Derek Denton labeled the primordial emotions, because they're ancient in the animal kingdom, and they command a particular action. And if those have been around for that long, then that suggests that there is a lot of commonality between what humans experience and what the other animals have to cope with.
Okay. But commonality isn't the same as being equally sophisticated, for a lack of a better term, right? Do these sort of primordial emotions, again, hunger, et cetera, primordial states that lead to primordial emotions. I mean, does that mean that chimpanzees or elephants, in Happy's case, or other creatures would experience the entire range of emotions that we humans identify? Satisfaction, fulfillment, disdain, disgust, all of those emotions.
Well, clearly each species, including us, has its own particular capacities, its particular sort of ways of interacting with the world, its particular needs, drives, and reactions. And so to that extent, I think it's probably not correct that they're all, as you say, identical. Humans also have a very sophisticated use of language that probably has extremely deep implications on how we experience the world.
Go ahead.
Well, I once followed a lion all night long as she walked across the Serengeti Plains from her territory through other neighboring pride's territories until she reached a small pool of water. It was the middle of a drought and she was thirsty. And she drank, and then she walked all the way back. And in that interim, she wasn't hunting, she wasn't interacting with other prides. She was driven in her choice, and she had to navigate a map of her world to find that particular spot. And the interesting thing about this is she wasn't walking alone, she was walking with her cub. And so, you know, you ask how might the notion of a primordial emotion inform what we think about animal emotions in general. Here's something motivated by thirst, but also by the bond between this mother and her cub to travel together. So That seems to me to be something that we can identify with in the animal world, right? That's something that's very familiar to the human condition, but it's not unique to the human condition.
I suppose in the case of Happy, what the Non-Human Rights Project, who unfortunately could not join us live today, what they're asserting is this detention against Happy's will, right? But that requires knowledge of what the will of the elephant might be, or even whether she knows she is being detained. Can we measure that in an animal like an elephant?
We can measure the capacity for certain capabilities sometimes if we have clear enough thinking and clear enough scientific design. So there was a lovely experiment that has been done on children in which an experimenter offers the child a treat, such as a marshmallow, and then tells the child, I'll be back in a minute, and if you don't eat that one, you may have a better treat when I return. Maybe two marshmallows, maybe something else, but something better. And so then the child faces the conundrum of satisfy myself now or wait and let my future self be happier with a better treat. It's kind of a famous experiment in part because some people have filmed children in these moments and trying to find ways to distract themselves from the present temptation in order to get the better reward. So someone replicated an experiment something like this with cuttlefish and found that they are capable of doing the same thing, of delaying a particular reward in order to pick up a later, better expected reward.
So cuttlefish can forego immediate self-gratification, like kids in the marshmallow test? That's fascinating. David Scheel, hang on for just a second. We're talking this hour about our growing understanding of the cognitive and emotional states of animals and how that might inform how human beings view animals legally sometime in the future. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the question of whether science's increasing understanding of the cognitive and emotional states of especially highly intelligent, highly social animals might force a question of what legal rights animals should have in the human world. I'm joined today by David Scheel. He's a professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University. He's with us from Anchorage. And Professor Scheel, just before the break, you kind of wowed me with the idea that cuttlefish can essentially pass the marshmallow test just like a five-year-old might, which is amazing. How is that? First of all, how is that even measured, that the cuttlefish foregoes the immediate reward in favor of a later one?
It was measured in the same way, by setting up a situation where the cuttlefish understood that certain rewards would appear at certain intervals. You can't tell the cuttlefish that the way you can the child, but you can train them to expect that. And then forcing the cuttlefish into a choice by making sure that if it went for the immediately available reward, the other reward would not be available later. And once the cuttlefish has learned that conditionality, they then seemed willing in the experiment to delay for the better reward.
Okay. And so what are the implications of that to you as a marine biologist?
I have kind of been interested in What kind of capacities for different aspects of the animal experience, if you will, are present in different animals? And that's kind of a hard question because there's a lot of different aspects to look at or think about, and no one experience can really reveal a huge amount. You have to sort of sum up over many different observations and experiences. But what that says to me is that here's an animal that has a capacity for something that resembles planning, right? And maybe it's not planning in the conventional way that humans think about it, because the animal is not verbally in its head going, first I will do this, and then I will do this, and then I will do that. But it is changing its behavior now in anticipation of an expected future. And certainly that's one way to think about what planning is. And we've known that animals can do this for a long, long time. We've seen, you know, animals that cache food for the winter have phenomenal memories, but they also are doing something now in order to protect their future selves.
Yeah. Well, just let's stick with the marine world for another moment, since that's your area of expertise. I know you've mentioned before that, for example, an octopus, with every year, it seems like there's more and more that we learn about the range of what emotions octopus can feel, how they think. They can even make very specific choices. They can problem solve. I mean, is that all correct?
Well, we're learning a lot about octopuses. I think a lot of this interest has exploded because some years ago, the octopus was mentioned as a difficult case in the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness, which tried to advance the notion, advance the notion that animals, particularly social mammals, but in general mammals and probably birds, shared what in the declaration they called primary consciousness, and then mentioned octopuses as sort of a also another likely case. And then about a year ago, the UK has been moving to provide better legal protections for animals used in scientific study beyond just birds and mammals, and moved to some invertebrates, and they have included cephalopods. Mm. And so that has also accelerated the interest in how can we put some measure of objectivity on the question of the experience of pain by octopuses or crustaceans, or the awareness of the future, or their reactions to how do they perceive their environments, and all of these many different myriad capacities that we collectively think about as our experience.
Yeah. Well, Professor Scheel, let me put you on the spot a little bit here, because I know you're a scientist and not a legal scholar. But is there a line you might draw, and maybe you don't know where it is, but is it even the right framework to think about, you know, is there a point at which amongst certain species the similarity or the recognition of how sophisticated their thinking or emotional states are arrives at a point where you think it would be worth expanding the notion of certain human rights or bodily rights to those animals?
There was some news coverage a while back about some of the work that I do, in which the headline writers, shall we say, made claims that sounded like they were going beyond what we had actually included in the paper. And so there was a little response to this that got published, in which my co-authors and I mentioned that the idea of intentionality in animals, what they mean to do, admits of degrees. That is to say, every capacity that animals have doesn't exist as an on and off switch. It's not you're either conscious or you're not. It's not you can either plan or you cannot. It is, you know, there are every one of these abilities has elements that make it up, and these build up gradually, we believe, in evolution over the history of nervous systems, right? From the first animal that ever had one. So I don't really believe in too many hard lines in nature, particularly not in biology. It seems to me that what we're looking at is a gradual accumulation. So when do you go from a few bits of salt to a pile of salt, right? Mm-hmm. It's not any one particular grain that says, oh, now it's a pile. It's the gradual accumulation. And I think when we think about capacities in the animal kingdom, we'd be wise to keep that kind of an idea in mind.
Yeah. Well, Professor Scheel, stand by here for a second, because I just want to return to the case that has brought our attention to this bigger question of how do we understand the cognitive and emotional states of animals, and what impact should that have, if any, on an animal's legal standing in the human world. And of course, it's that case of Happy, the elephant that lives at the Bronx Zoo. And so we did speak to members of the Non-Human Rights Project. This is Elizabeth Stein, who is the staff attorney for Happy.
Her existence, we call it her, and rightfully so, her imprisonment and captivity at the Bronx Zoo is essentially that she is a solitary elephant. There is one other elephant, Patty, with whom she can have no contact for various reasons. And she and Patty share I believe it's a 1.5 acre enclosure. Part of that enclosure is a barn with a cement floor. As far as I am aware, the stall within which she lives is basically the size of her body.
Now, Stein says that elephants are matriarchal, highly social, have long ranges. So even living in a zoo in the best of circumstances is not how an elephant should be living.
To put it in the perspective of how an elephant should be living, elephants in the wild travel miles and miles and miles a day. And especially an elephant like Happy, who is female, would be the matriarch of a family. And she would have children, and they live together as family units, and they communicate with one another, and they have long-term memories. And this all goes to their extraordinary cognitive abilities. And very sadly for Happy, her captivity at the Bronx Zoo prevents any of these innate, natural, inherent qualities from being fulfilled.
And Stein and the Non-Human Rights Project add another twist here. She says that elephant cognition experts have testified that these limitations are harming Happy, that they're harming Happy physically and psychologically. And she also notes that back in 2005, scientists from Emory University gave Happy a self-recognition test. They put her in front of a large mirror and looked to see if Happy could recognize her own image. The elephant seemed to pass the test, which is considered to be an indicator of self-awareness. Now, again, seemed to pass the test. And that's why the Non-Human Rights Project is calling for the recognition of Happy's legal personhood so that the court can recognize her right to bodily liberty and move Happy to an elephant sanctuary. Now, could there be consequences? The court decided against this, just to reiterate. In a 5-2 ruling, the New York Appeals Court decided against this. But say another case like this down the line happens, and what if it's Happy again? Could there be other consequences to granting legal personhood to Happy?
We're asked, well, does this mean that we won't be able to have dogs? Does this mean that we won't be able to eat hamburgers? And our answer is that's not what we're talking about. Because in any civil rights movement, The pushback is always going to be the what ifs, but that's not the point of the common law. The point of the common law is to look at the case before you and say, okay, based on this, how am I to rule?
And Stein also adds that the Non-Human Rights Project is focused on just this one right, that habeas corpus right for happy. The rest, she says, would be for the courts to decide when, if and when, an appropriate time comes.
All we're looking for is the right to bodily liberty, because it's the violation of that right that makes her detention at, let's say, the Bronx Zoo unlawful. We're not asking for any other rights.
That's Elizabeth Stein, staff attorney at the Non-Human Rights Project and Happy the Elephants New York Council. Well, joining us now is Richard Kupp. He's professor of law at the Pepperdine Caruso School of Law and an animal welfare advocate, and he joins us from Malibu, California. Professor Kupp, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So let me just put it simply in terms of how far my understanding goes of the legal argument that the Non-Human Rights Project is making, that because Happy the Elephant is an individual in a species that has certain needs in terms of how it lives normally, social, territorial, etc., and Happy in particular seems to have shown some form of self-awareness, that these are enough to request bodily liberty for her, and because she's under human care right now, the only legal tool the Non-Human Rights Project has is that habeas corpus argument. So, would you agree or disagree? And if you disagree, what's the argument against it?
I would respectfully disagree that that's the only tool that's available. I want to start by saying that I love the discussion that you started with regarding the advancements our scientists have had with understanding of animals' potential consciousness and animals' capacity to suffer. And I stand in the position of firmly advocating for evolution of protections of animals based largely on this increased scientific understanding of what animals are capable of. Society's laws evolve as we change our understanding of science or as social mores and values change. And it seems that one of the biggest driving forces in creating more legal protections for animals is enhanced understanding on so many levels with so many animals of seems like almost every day we see headlines or stories about animals being able to do this or appreciate this or suffer this that we didn't understand before. So I'm an advocate for change. Another thing pushing for change, I think, in our society, by the way, is our increasing evolution from an agrarian society to an urban suburban society where we just love our pets to death. And that's the kind of animals we encounter in our daily lives more often now. And, you know, if you went back 150 years ago, we'd have animals that we may have loved, but we may have also killed for dinner, you know, on the farm. So we're changing as a society, and law changes this way. Now, my point of disagreement is there's what I would call a centrist alternative. A reactionary position would be to say, you know, leave us alone. We're doing fine with animals. We have protections for animals. We don't need any evolution. To me, a radical position would be to say, we need to really change our legal system to take personhood, which has been reserved for human beings who, as a norm, have the capacity to have sufficient accountability to be treated as responsible members of our society, whereas no other animals have that. We need to change that and say that at least some animals, maybe a whole lot of animals, can be legal persons. A centrist approach would be to say, let's embrace evolution of our laws, but let's do it through animal welfare. Let's do it through our legislatures primarily. So I'm completely open to any arguments that might be made about whether elephants should be in zoos, for example. But the appropriate venue for those arguments is to go through a legislature which the New York legislature has lots of legislation thus far with regard to how various kinds of animals can be treated. The New York legislature can change that. You have seen dramatic changes. I have some illustrations I could give you, dramatic changes in the last 30 or 40 years with regard to animal welfare legislation. And I think that's the approach rather than legal personhood.
Okay, so Professor Richard Kupp and Professor David Scheel, stand by for a second. We'll talk more about that. And really, I think the fundamental question that's being raised here is, in what direction, if any, should this evolution of human beings' understanding of their legal and moral obligations when it comes to our dominion over the natural world, in what direction should that go? So back in a moment. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about this question that has been raised over the past few years by animal legal activists about whether certain animals, even just a particular individual few animals, should be granted personhood rights. Now, a recent case went all the way up to the New York State Appeals Court of Appeals, failed there in a 5-2 decision against the advocates arguing on behalf of Happy the Elephant. But the deeper question here about how the more we learn scientifically regarding the complexities of animal cognition and even animal emotions, whether that should force some kind of legal, legislative, moral change in how we humans view our dominion over the natural world. Now, I'm joined today by David Scheel. He's a professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University. And Richard Kupp is with us as well. He's a professor of law at Pepperdine School of Law in California. Now, Professor Kupp, just before the break, you had said that these personhood rights apply only to people. Elizabeth Stein at the Non-Human Rights Project has a different view of that, because she says that a common confusion around Happy's case is exactly what legal personhood really means.
Personhood is not analogous to being human. There are all kinds of legal persons who are not human beings. I have found that individuals get hung up with, if you're asking the court to recognize Happy as a person, aren't you saying that Happy is to be recognized as a human being? And the answer is no, because really all legal personhood is the capacity for a right.
Now, Richard Kupp, I did hear you clearly earlier when you said the courts are not the right place to decide this, and perhaps the better place is to look to the legislature, and we will come back to that. But I just want to pursue this legal question a little bit more, because to the point that Stein is making there, you know, corporations have certain personhood rights. They can hold property, enter contracts, sue and be sued. So they are not recognized as human beings, but they have certain personhood rights. Why wouldn't a similar thinking apply to animals?
That's really one of the most common questions that's faced in this issue, and it's a good one for that reason. And I think it's one that might sound a little bit like a fastball question, but it's kind of a softball when you talk it through, because Courts have recognized that corporate personhood exists, and the New York court highlighted this in its decision rejecting animal legal personhood, that corporate personhood exists because the corporation is serving as a proxy for the human owners. It's a human creation, and it's a convenience that's set up. We can like corporate personhood or not. I'm agnostic with regard to this field on that question, and I know that it's controversial, but it does exist as a vehicle to promote the interests of the humans and the rights and responsibilities of the humans who put it together. So animals are not a proxy for humans. They're completely different. So corporate personhood, the New York court said, is effectively an extension or a byproduct of the focus on humanity and personhood, and doesn't serve as a good challenge to the idea that personhood is centered on humanity.
Yeah. Point well taken. And by the way, I'm not trying any fastballs or softballs or curveballs or even even knuckleballs here today.
I didn't see it as a try. That's my evaluation, not yours.
I was just genuinely curious because, again, this case was brought into a court. And so I'm just trying to understand better sort of some of the arguments for and against it. But David Scheel, let me turn back to you here because Richard Kupp did say clearly that an evolution in humanity's treatment of animals or how we view what should be acceptable or unacceptable I keep using this word dominion, but purposefully over the natural world should be something that's done through a legislative process. I don't want to get bogged down too much by procedural questions, but what changes would you want to see, Professor Scheel?
Well, I'm not a legal or social scholar, and that seems like that's the realm it falls in. But it does seem to me that humans have had relationships with animals ever since there have been humans of various kinds. And so one of the things that I see that I like is that we're engaging with this concept. We're treating it as a serious question, and we're treating the nature of human and animal relationships as something intrinsic to humanity that we should be engaged with. And so I'm glad to see that we are.
Mm. Well, so here's how I begin to think of this, that, again, this is why we really wanted to start with what science knows and is learning right now, because it seems to me, from what I heard you say, Professor Scheel, that that we are learning more and more, or at least observing more and more, that there is some kind of cognitive complexity or more cognitive complexity in animals, social complexity, emotional complexity than we previously understood. And so, you know, what I wonder is, even taking the legal question out of it, are we at a point where if we're even going to ask, should an elephant like Happy be kept in more or less isolation in the Bronx Zoo, is that all that different than, you know, as Richard Kupp was saying, in urban and suburban environments, like a dog, very social, domesticated pack animal, be kept home alone all day long while all its owner and its family are at work and school? I mean, I heard years ago, Temple Grandin say her biggest concern about animals right now was the epidemic of lonely dogs. I mean, is that an outlandish question, Professor Scheel?
It's not a question that's never occurred to me before. So I don't think it's an outlandish question at all. One of the things that you see when you approach the world as an ecologist is that a lot of what happens and a lot of what we understand is situated in a context. Animals don't just exist in and of themselves. They exist in relationship to their environment. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways to think about that is that everything becomes a little bit contextual at one stage or another. And it seems to me that humanity's relationships with all animals are very diverse. And so trying to say across the board one thing or the other ignores the context.
Yeah.
So that we want to be taking these conversations in a contextualized way.
Mm. Professor Kupp, your thoughts on this?
That makes sense to me, if I'm understanding correctly, that each animal is going to have different needs, different capacities, and that fits completely within an evolving animal welfare paradigm. An example that maybe could be thrown out is that we used to do scientific experiments on great apes, particularly chimpanzees. There was HIV research that was done on chimpanzees quite some time ago, when at earlier stages of the spread of HIV. My understanding is that those studies, you know, were well-intentioned but weren't that productive. And through processes other than legal personhood, National Institution of Health decided that they wanted to stop or encourage stopping most research on chimpanzees because they weren't finding that there was enough benefit from that research to justify the pain and the emotional cost to the chimpanzees, given the chimpanzees' capacities. So I believe the National Academy of Science was involved, the NIH is involved, and I think, as far as I can, my research goes, there's zero or almost zero invasive research of great apes going on in the United States right now. A change from 20 years ago, based on increased understanding of specifically those great apes. So if what I'm hearing is we need to look into each species and try to decide what's appropriate for that species, I'm 100% in favor of that.
Mm. So let me just swing over to the what do you call it, reactionary side of things here for a moment, Professor Kupp, because, I mean, there is a point of view that might say this entire conversation is utterly ridiculous because, you know, if we're talking about evolution, Homo sapien right now, for better or for worse, at least at this moment in time, we have bigger brains. We're capable of much more sophisticated language. We have technology, very complex social structures. I mean, all of the things that make people people are the things that confer to us that dominion over the natural world that I was talking about. And so therefore, really, what's the point here? We're the top of the heap. We're evolutionarily superior. So even pursuing some kind of expansion of rights or protections on animals is kind of ridiculous because no matter what we do, we will have dominion over them. What mm-hmm. do you think?
Well, I think it's actually exactly right, factually, that we'll have dominion over animals. Dominion might be kind of a loaded word, but if dominion means control, well, obviously we do have control. And then the question is, what are we going to do with it? Does dominion or control mean that we just show a blind eye to the suffering of animals? Immanuel Kant, the famous philosopher, had a great quote where he said something to the effect of, the person who is hard to animals becomes hard also to men. What does it say about us if simply because we can treat animals as completely utilitarian objects for our benefit without any concern for their welfare, that doesn't speak well to humans. It doesn't speak well to our empathy. It doesn't speak well to how we're going to treat other human beings. So I think there's a big difference between what we could do because we actually do have control of animals and morally what we should do.
Mm. You know, I want to just quickly ask you, Professor Kupp, the same question I asked Professor Scheel earlier, the more we learn about certain species' capacity for, let's say, thinking or feeling that may be recognizable to humans, does it actually, you know, call into question, or what's the point at which it would call into question? You know, food I'm putting aside because that's a whole massive can of worms on its own. But you know, things like zoos or pet ownership or even anything like that.
Yeah, I think it's a sliding scale. I don't know if that's the right term, but I think it relates to balancing of what sort of benefits come from this use of the animal versus what sort of costs there are. So if you take zoos, for example, they're particularly controversial because they are alleged to be purely for human entertainment. If you talk to zoo people, they'll say we are focused a lot on conservation and education and things like that. So there's some controversy. But if you go to, you said you're going to stay away from food, that's, you know, obviously a more primary issue. We take biomedical research as another area where we could say, you know, some biomedical research might save human lives. Some might make better cosmetics. You know, we might want to make a differentiation with regard to both the importance of the research that is being engaged in and the nature of the animal that's involved in the research. Research with chimpanzees might need to be analyzed quite differently than research with fish, for example, based on our current understanding. So my general plea, I guess, for lack of a better word, is that we need to look on a case-by-case basis about what the science is telling us, what the benefits are. There needs to be a clear personhood line, I believe, between humans and animals because of the norm of humans' capacity for accountability that makes them persons in society without animals having that norm. But then beyond that, we need to decide on a case-by-case basis and not shy away from it, what's the appropriate use for these animals? What do we feel like this is not, this is beyond, this use should be stopped because we think it's not worth it or should be limited in some way.
Well, Professor Scheel, we've got about a minute left to go. And I'm wondering if you could leave us with, is there an example of another animal or area of research that, just sort of gives you pause or leads you to ask more questions about what else is capable out there in the animal kingdom?
Oh, you have put me on the spot. You know, I think an awful lot of research gives me pause at one time or another. Sometimes it's because you think, well, we've known for a long time that animals can do this. Is this really the first time science has gotten around to documenting it? You know, the ancients contemplated whether dogs used logic in making choices. And, you know, we're just now sometimes getting to the point of scientifically documenting how that cognition works.
Yeah. Well, David Scheel, professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University, with us today from Anchorage. Professor Scheel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Richard Cupp, professor of law at the Pepperdine Caruso School of Law and an animal welfare advocate. Professor Cupp, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.